Hello, my name's Paul Greatrix, and the latest episode of the podcast finds me talking to Richard Brabner, Executive Chair of UPP Foundation and Director of ESG, about his very specific imagined university. James Timpson is Richard's non-cricketing hero, and the university embodies his approach to social purpose, combining this with the civic university ethos championed by the much-missed Bob Kerslake. The university's home is a campus in Harold Wood, hence the name, a less than prosperous community to the northeast of London in the London borough of Havering, where Richard grew up. Not only will it be a beautiful, inspiring and sustainable campus, with no concrete visible, it will also have community learning zones distributed across the borough. Student housing will be based on a new model, with some on and off campus provision. The undergraduate offer is centred on five novel interdisciplinary degree programmes and includes a major service learning element as a core feature, as well as strong community engagement activity. The university also has, unsurprisingly, an innovative approach to widening participation, including a bridging module for the homeless, care leavers and ex-offenders to provide them with an opportunity to start a degree. As Vice-Chancellor, Richard will be aiming to maintain a strong focus on the core mission of the university and to keep structures as simple as possible, although he doesn't rule out expansions to other locations if a big Timpson donation can be secured. He's employed a Director of Happiness to support the well-being of all staff and will seek happiness feedback on a weekly basis. Meanwhile, the only thing banned at Harold Wood Uni is the banning of other people. And finally, the institution's anthem is a quirky number by the Kinks, which is sure to cause some debate at graduations. It's a really good episode, and I'm sure you'll enjoy it. Hello, everyone, and welcome to the latest edition of the My Imaginary University podcast. And this time, it's my great pleasure to introduce Richard Brabner, who's Executive Chair of the UPP Foundation and Director of ESG there. Welcome, Richard.
Hello. Honoured to be here, Paul. Thank you so much.
It's great to have you. And I, for one, am very excited to hear what imaginative institution that you have come up with for us. And as people know, I've got no idea what you're going to tell me. So we'll listen straight away to the big picture of the institution, the imaginary university that you've created. So over to you, Richard.
Okay. All right. Thanks, Paul. So as somebody who recently had a big birthday, as a 40-year-old, you probably shouldn't have heroes, right? But I've got sort of two heroes, and they're both called James. So one of them's not particularly relevant for this podcast. So that's Jimmy Anderson, you know, England's greatest ever, you know, seam bowler, 700 plus wickets, most wickets,
a worthy
bowler ever.
Hero,
yeah, of course, you know, if he wanted to be the coach of the cricket team or take an adult education course or something and be part of the university's cricket team. And of course, I think he's got a very good chance of getting an honorary degree. Great. But the James that is particularly relevant for today is James Timpson, or Lord Timpson, as he now is, you know, prisons minister. But of course, most well known for being the sort of chief exec of Timpson Group, who last year published a book around his experience called The Happy Index. And the reason why I suppose he is partly an inspiration for this university is his real commitment to what you might call social value. Now, James Timpson is very anti-jargon, so I've already sort of broken the rules by saying social value, because he probably wouldn't say it like that. And of course, what he is best known for is, from the last 10, 20 years, the Timpson Group employing something in the region of over 10% of their workforce of ex-offenders, something like 600 people, and they do loads of other brilliant stuff. They've got a really good sort of commitment to their colleagues and so on, which we'll go into. So part of my university will have sort of real social purpose, to use more jargon, really embedded throughout the university. And then the other part of it, which is a similar theme but distinct, as people that might be listening to this podcast, if they've met me or know about me, one of the things I really care about is the civic role of universities and their commitment and their connection to place. And obviously, the foundation that I run did a big commission a few years ago that was chaired by the late, great Bob Keslake. Now, the civic movement is obviously bigger and beyond sort of Bob, but he was a great sort of figurehead for it and a real inspiration behind it. So my university would also be looking to him and thinking about, well, what would Bob do and what would Bob say? So they're the sort of two people that would really be the inspiration behind the heart of my university. So both the social value piece and also this, being really integrated and part of its community and place.
So is it a is it a traditional urban or campus-based university? Is it, are the is that your starting point, and it's the kind of the mission and ethos and drive of the place which is different from the norm? So is it a physical presence in one place?
So it does have a physical presence in it's got a campus university in one place, and then it's got other sites in the re in that local area. Now let me just this might surprise people, but you're talking about civic and place linked to sort of leveling up and geographical inequality. You'd think this university might be in a post-industrial town, it might be in a coastal community, it might be in the north. No, that's not where it's going to be. Where my university is going to be, because it is my university and the place that I care most about is where obviously I'm from, and I'm being very selfish here, but it's actually going to be in a place called Harold Wood, which is in the London borough of Havering. And the reason why I say that is that Havering as a borough is one of what you might call the donut boroughs in Greater London. It defies what people expect London to be. If there was an election tomorrow, I suspect one or two reform MPs would be elected. It voted very heavily to leave the European Union. There are some wealthy areas in Havering, in places like Emerson Park, in Upminster, but there's also some real deprivation too. If you look at the sort of polar data in Harold Hill, which is next to Harold Wood, there's a sort of A road in between, and basically it's got some of the sort of polar one places. There are lots of polar two places in Havering, in South Hornchurch, in Raynham, and so on. It's a very old demographic in that particular borough, and so it's a real mix, a real deprivation. And actually, the type of place it is, you could argue, is has lots of characteristics which are similar to what a Theresa May government might call a left behind community, or a Boris Johnson government might talk about levelling up, or a Keir Starmer government might talk about sort of geographical inequality or whatever. And so my university is going to be in this place called Harold Wood. It's where I grew up. It's where I played cricket for years, where I still go back every Saturday, from where I now live in South London. There's some land there that could absolutely have a new university. And of course, given this current government is backing the builders, not the blockers, we've had no problems in swatting away all the NIMBYs and building our new institution. And it's been inspired by sort of the best bits of the rest of the sector. So like many of the sort of red bricks, it has been really supported by local business people, local dignitaries. The working classes in the area have helped support the sort of scoping of the soft market test, if you want to call it, for the institution. Clearly, in the modern world, it can't fully fund it, but it's through that it's got lots of support from business and government to set up this institution, and build this institution. The style of the campus institution is a bit different to what you would expect from sort of a place really connected to its place, though. It has got the ethos from the campus element to some extent of a 60s plate glass type university, because the student experience is really, really important, obviously, as well as it being connected to its place. And so it's a sort of small to medium sized institution in that regard. Everyone feels part of its community, but it's much more open than a typical, it's more in an urbanish area. It's not sort of somewhere distinct. I went to Essex. It's not in Wivenhoe compared to a Colchester. It's really part of its sort of place. And the one big difference to a 60s university is there's no concrete. It's not been inspired by this disgusting brutalist architecture. It's actually got beautiful architecture and actually what people, the public, and students like and want. We've had a partnership with an organization called Create Streets, run by Nicholas Boyce Smith, to sort of create a beautiful campus, which is sort of linked to his theme around popular gentle density. And there's been a real sort of engagement with the local community in making it both something which the community can use and students, and something that's beautiful and they actually really want to engage with, and actually inspires pride in its particular place. And so that's the sort of concept of the campus. But alongside the campus, Paul, there are lots of we actually, given it's a real civic place, social values at the heart of this, we don't expect people just to come onto the university. We have to go to them. And so we're actually helping to revitalize the high streets in different parts of Havering by creating what we call university community zones in different high streets, where in partnership with the local authority and others, with the FE College, with schools, with charities, with business, we've created these spaces in the high street to really create more footfall into the high street. And they're sort of open noon till night. So you might have a nursery provision in there. You might have the FE College delivering sort of stuff in there. Lots of our students and staff deliver sort of civic projects in these particular places. We've got obviously pop-up cafes and restaurants and businesses in there. And a lot of our postgraduate adult education, both the sort of intramural stuff, but also the sort of postgraduate elements, is delivered within the high street in the evenings, à la Birkbeck.
Right. There's lots to unpack in there, Richard. Let me just come back to the design. So it's a kind of 60s style campus, but with no concrete, and therefore, well, I mean, many people like the concrete, but of course, the legacy of it is disastrous in terms of maintenance. But nevertheless, you're talking about style and appearance as well, and the kind of feel of the campus. So it's a very kind of contemporary, but nevertheless, non-concrete based set. But I'm just struggling to
Be
get a
sustainable.
benchmark
So
of what it
everything
looks
is
like.
passive house. Everything is passive house across the modern campus. We're very sustainable too, but the style of it is sort of Edwardian, but in a modern context.
Right. Okay. So it's lovely, oldie looking brick is what we're talking about. Excellent. Right, good. Got a sense of that. Okay. And I get the stuff about the kind of the outreach and the community. So, but is and it's a kind of integrated into that local community as a setting as well. The bit that you didn't mention, I like everything you described, is what do the students do in terms of their accommodation? Because obviously that's something that I'm sure that you've got some ideas on. Are they dispersed within the community as well, or is there a kind of physical student accommodation on campus?
Student accommodation tends to be in the sort of outward campus element of it. There's a mix of different types of halls of residence. We're trying to create a new product, Paul, in terms of the en suite sort of model, as you know, is incredibly popular amongst students and their parents. And actually, it's really difficult to actually create something different to that because of the demand. But we're trying to sort of test things out where we can actually have something that's inspired by the past, where you have lots of students in a particular sort of halls of residence or flat, like a 16 type flat, because we think actually that's really good for community and well-being. So we're trying to recreate that in a modern context, and as a result of that, offer a different price point, I suppose, for students from lower income backgrounds to do that. Now, we have a mixture of residential students and commuter students, but the majority of our undergraduates are residential.
They are kind of the dispersed, those blocks or townhouses or whatever they might be are dispersed rather than being collected together adjacent to the
Yeah,
teaching
they're
point.
integrated within the
Right.
whole campus.
Yeah. Excellent. Excellent. And we're talking kind of, as you say, kind of medium-sized institution, which will make that integration probably easier than if it was a massive set of buildings parachuted into this community. But in terms of and you talked about the kind of adult education and evening class offer, but in terms of the disciplinary it's covered, is it a kind of comprehensive offer? Is it very work focused? Is it, lots of arts and humanities, lots of engineering? What's the range of provision?
So we're focused on, our university's focused around the core challenges that have a relevant local, national, and global context, and they're taught within those different contexts too. And so we offer for an undergraduate level, we offer 5 degrees, basically, and they're all incredibly interdisciplinary, as you would appreciate. So our 5 degrees are so geographical inequality and left behind communities. We've got a degree on that because this is a challenge in the UK, but it's a challenge across the Western world. We have a degree on profit and purpose, as you probably would expect. So ethical business and sustainability, essentially, that is a degree on that. We have a degree on demographic decline and aging societies, which is linked to sort of both havering, but also big challenge in the in not just the Western world, but in parts lots of parts of the globe around how we deal with our demographic declines and what we do around aging societies. We've got one on geopolitics and security. Now you might argue, well, what's this got to do with the area and so on? Well, I believe Havering in Hornchurch, the first ever Zeppelin to be shot down was in Hornchurch. So there's a history there in terms of, both First and Second World Wars. There's some clear links there. It's obviously on the edge of the Thames. There's some security elements to that and so on. So we've got that.
Yeah.
That's an important degree. And then obviously one is on technology and productivity. London is going to be the tech capital of Europe. So clearly at the sort of edge of that, we want to play into that game too, as well as sort of help solve local, national and global sort of productivity puzzle. So they're the 5 degrees, but as you can appreciate, there's hugely interdisciplinary. Postgraduate offer is naturally a bit narrower than that. So you're going to have stuff that's a bit more specific, but we're willing to learn, and we're always willing to change. And so if we feel at some point in the future that that doesn't work, and that we need a new model and a new restructure, then we're definitely up for that too. I suppose beyond the sort of interdisciplinary curriculum, and it's really important that students are interdisciplinary, so there is an expectation that they will take modules across different disciplinary areas to make up their particular degree. Service learning is really important to us, what they call it in America.
Yeah.
We're really inspired by what happened in New Orleans at Tulane University, where after Hurricane Katrina, they completely transformed their curriculum as part of their sort of changing mission of their institution to really serve their city and region. And as a result of that, I think every single undergraduate student has to do something like 40 hours of service learning that's accredited a year
Right.
to really support the regeneration of New Orleans. So we expect the same. So there's going to be a minimum of 40 hours of service learning, which is accredited as part of your degree. And students can go off and find their own service learning partnerships as long as it's properly accredited. But we do have sort of 5 areas that we look at that. So we have a big tutoring program to support raising attainment in our schools in local communities, and students will go off and help raise attainment in literacy and numeracy. We've got a real big focus on sustainability, so there's lots of work with lots of businesses and charities and local authorities around supporting local sustainability, whether it's biodiversity or campaigns around reducing consumption and so on. There's lots of stuff around aging, so we really like it when students can go into local care homes and not do not they're not employed, so it's not working. It's actually improving the experience of the residents in those care homes. It's actually participating with them in activities and supporting them, building relationships with people there. And of course, in terms of the going in and supporting businesses, developing plans around their social purpose or around productivity and utilizing technology and so on and things like that within sort of small SMEs in our community. So they're the sort of things that students will do that are accredited as part of their degree.
So there's a lot, and that's really a really interesting linkage between those broad-based interdisciplinary subject areas and the and the activities of students outside the classroom, which also count towards their degree. So you mentioned at the beginning that one of the important dimensions of the university was the quality of the student experience, right? And obviously you've described some of that now. Are there other aspects of the student experience beyond that, the academic and the kind of service learning, as well as that residential experience you've already talked about? There are the dimensions that you need to share with us.
I think it's worth saying around the service learning why we love it so much from our student experience point of view is that what's so great about it being mandatory is that it's sort of there's lots of students that sort of have a typical residential experience have beyond the sort of academic in the sort of extracurricular, co-curricular, really benefit from that sort of immersive elements of the student experience, which are so difficult to untangle and measure, but we know from common sense that makes such a difference to their experience and their future prospects. And so by integrating that into the curriculum in a really formal way, it means whether you're a commuter student, a residential student, whatever your background is, you're actually going to benefit from some of this. And really at the heart of this is supporting how students can develop relationships. Because it's relationships, whether in your student experience or in your graduate experience, which are going to really make a difference to your ability to thrive. And so it's formalizing in a way that is possible through practical application of what you're doing from your degree, the ability to learn how to really sort of engage stakeholders, if you want to put it in that whole terms, effectively. I think beyond that, we obviously have a really good program around the community on the campus and off the campus, as you'd expect, both supporting the local community but also the community on campus. So every students are really heavily engaged in clubs and societies, as you would expect, from this type of university, which really supports that. There's a real focus, obviously there's been a big focus in recent years around student mental health. Now, we're not the richest university in the world, but what we really care about is obviously for students that we have a really good well-being services, but it's around prevention for us as much as anything. How can we, how can we, and that's that links to relationships, that those fostering those natural connections for either what you're doing or how the campus is built and everything that is so important to us. I think beyond the sort of that element of the student experience, it's a real focus on innovative practice in widening participation for this university. So there's obviously been a big agenda from the IFS recently around measuring your impact, which obviously we agree, is important. But where we never should lose sight on how we can scale and grow impact for the hardest to reach people in society. So we have, and it's not just about us being innovative, it's actually about scaling other great ideas that are elsewhere in the sector. So, for example, there's a brilliant project at Chichester University where they've created this bridging module in partnership with a local homeless shelter, where if somebody does the course for 12 weeks, essentially an access to higher education course, who are living in the homeless shelter, they can then go and study for a degree at the university. We've been there and reviewed this as a university, the University of Harold Wood, and we know that it's transforming people's lives. So we wanted to adapt that here and scale it up. So we've, sought out partners to do that, and that's been a big successful program, that bridging module supporting homeless people, care experienced people, and of course, given we're sort of inspired by James Timpson, there's a real focus on ex-offenders, as you'd expect, in studying at the university, but not just studying, and we'll obviously come to that in a moment. So yeah, really having that real focus on incubation, scaling up, innovative practice around WP for the hardest to reach groups is important to us too.
Yeah, I mean that's the very thing I was going to ask about, because you talked about the kind of values that you'd derived from James Timpson's work, and that issue around supporting those who were offenders who'd come back out into the community, and the really incredible work that Timpson's have done in that regard. And I was obviously you've talked about that in relation to students. I mean, I was going to ask about in relation to the wider workforce as well, because presumably that ethos translates there as well.
Yes, absolutely. So I think that's a really important point. So, and it links in with, I suppose, it also links in with WP, because there's a sort of virtuous circle here. So, like Timpson's, we've really developed this ethos that a good proportion of our workforce are from challenging backgrounds. So we clearly have adopted programs around how can ex-offenders, both academics and professional services, and how we can really cleverly support them. We know there are safeguarding issues, but we're tackling that in effective ways, as other businesses are doing, to support that. And linked to the sort of WP programs around programs for people to work at our university who have suffered homelessness and are care experienced and so on. We, like some other really progressive universities in the sector, actively recruit staff from the poorest boroughs in Havering, because we think that not only is that great for them, but it's also changing the perception of the university in these places, which is really, really fundamentally important. The lots of polling that the sector has done, and sort of very good corporate foundations poll that have done in the past, tell us that, whilst actually, universities, there are lots of people that actually like universities. There's a big block of people that don't really know anything about higher education, do not engage in higher education, and see them as sort of big corporates in that sense. And so they don't dislike them, but they're very neutral about universities. And that's the type of people that we're really trying to engage with and change the perception of higher education, not just for us, but for the whole sector as a whole. And so there's also, in terms of academic roles too, there's obviously been a big agenda around EDI, which we fully support, but that on top of that, and what's really important in terms of the I bit of it, is around class. So we do focus on issues around identity, but we have a big focus too on social mobility for academic roles in terms of getting academics from working class backgrounds into roles here too.
It's a really, really terrific vision. And given that this institution is in your home patch, I mean, I'm assuming that you are, and you're driving it forward. It's all your ideas, right? So I'm assuming that you will be the first vice chancellor of this institution, and you'll be the one enacting all of these terrific innovations. But what kind of vice chancellor will you be, Richard? I mean, will this turn you into someone slightly less benign and open?
My style is, as you could probably tell by this conversation, it's more vision and leadership, Paul, rather than management. We recruit lots of great people that can enact what this university needs to actually do. But I think where I really annoy people for the right reasons is that I'm really focused on maintaining the mission of the university, and we don't want that mission creep. We don't want to be doing everything. That's not what this university is about. We've got to be focused. We've got to keep the structures of the institution as simple as possible. We're trying to be in a post-bureaucratic age for our institution. And so, we're trying to keep it as lean as we possibly can to make sure that we're reinvesting in the areas that we need to reinvest in. Now, we have values around creativity and entrepreneurialism across our student staff body, but we are very wary of what James Timpson would call entrepreneuritis, which is basically, trying to do more and more things and then adding more and more layers of people and bureaucracy, when actually it's not li linked to what the core mission of the organisation is. So we're sort of really, as a leader, I'm really hot on that too.
Right, so you will be keeping things simple from the top, the top downwards. I'm sure there are many, many other things going on in the University of Harold Wood, which I have to say doesn't really, chime for me as a name. But who am I? I'm not in the target audience for this, right?
Well, to be honest with you,
But
Paul, what we are concerned about is that a future leader might go, well, actually, nobody's heard of Harold Wood, so let's call it the University of Greater London, for example, right? Because, Absolutely not. So it's in our statute that they cannot call it the University of Greater London. We are absolutely connected to the place that we're part of. Now, there has been discussions with the governing body around the success, because obviously it's an incredibly successful institution in its first decade of being around. And so do we actually look to be inspired by sort of the multi-academy trusts in the school sector and try and create sort of a multi-university trust, as it were, and expand in other places which could benefit from a university like the University of Harold Wood? Now, if we were to do that, we may change our name. So we might call ourselves like you have the Harris Academy, we might be the Timpson University, Harold Wood, and then you might have the Timpson University, Oldham, or whatever. But at the moment, we're just sort of dipping our toes in the water around whether that's feasible or not.
And he's going to have to come up with some money if that's going to happen.
I think so. And he's, obviously he's going to have to step down from government before he can actually do that. But we're in conversations, aren't we? So we'll see what happens.
Excellent, excellent. So, are there any other distinctive features that we've not covered that you need to share with us? Because there's lots of different dimensions of the institution that you have shared, but are there other things that we need to know about?
So we're really focused on the colleague experience, because we think the colleague experience enables a better student experience. So we're really focused. This sounds a bit cliche, but we want happy colleagues, basically. We have a director of happiness in our university, and their team, and they're really looking after colleagues as well as students. And so what, how do they actually do that? Well, it's not part of HR, let's be honest. It's separate to that, because they're really trying to get to know our colleagues and what's holding them back and what are the things that we can do to help them thrive. Now, we know that, people's personal lives can affect their performance. We know there are a whole range of different things. And so it's really getting to know these people and understand them and seeing them, what can the university to do on that. Like Timpson's, we've got a great package of support for our colleagues. So we've got holiday homes all over the UK, like there. And so when particularly in the professional services, but if there's, I know lots of academics have got their second homes in the south of France. But when there's a need for a break or a holiday, you can apply to the university and go, we'd love to spend a weekend in Suffolk or in the or Northumbria or in the Cotswolds or in the Lake District. We know that there's lots of leave in comparison to other sectors in higher education, but that doesn't mean that we can't do more. So when colleagues, either academics or professional services, there's an important occasion in their lives. Let's say they're a grandparent and it's their grandchild's sixth birthday, they absolutely can have the day off for that, or their child or daughters on having their own graduation or whatever. That's then sort of an extra day off, as you would probably expect. Even if your pet has passed away, we know that these things can affect people, and therefore they can have a day off to sort of create their own sort of memory
I mean
and so on.
that's all lovely, but when you started down the route of happiness, I must admit I had this horrible image of people dressed in clown outfits going around trying to cheer people up, which would be the antithesis
No,
of happiness from my perspective.
the innovation in this respect, everyone's different. And so that's the thing around the director of happiness role. Of course, there'll be some people that will sneer at the name, and that's fine. We don't mind that. But the purpose is to really get to know colleagues across the business and see what makes them tick, and they're all different, recognizing that people are different. The thing that we're also doing is we're sort of inspired by, there's a thing called Teacher Tap, an organization which basically that surveys teachers on a daily basis around various different things. Now, we're not going to survey our staff on a daily basis, but they've all got this app, and we do ask them every Friday, and it's three questions, and it literally takes them 30 seconds. We're not asking them to comment. It's literally press a button and then they're doing it. And we ask them three questions from different aspects of the institution. One of them is the same, and that is, on a scale of 1 to 10, how happy are they, basically? And so we can track the general mood of the colleague, staff, team, and we review that every Monday morning as a senior team. And if we see that there's, a trend of actually, we try and really get into the details of what's going on and change that.
Great. We're getting to the end there, Richard, but there are a couple more things we just need to quickly cover. I mean, you've already banned unhappiness, right? But are there other things that are not allowed in your university in Harold Wood?
So, linked to having a great colleague experience is a really big focus on high standards, as you would probably appreciate, Paul. And so, what is that? We're not obviously, we're a we believe in freedom, as all universities do, and we recognise that. This whole debate in the recent years that students have been protesting and trying to cancel politicians for decades, right? Our issue is not around that at all. We expect that sort of part of them, part and parcel of the student experience to some extent. But we do have a very strong policy on academic standard in this regard. And so we are banning other academics trying to cancel other academics. We don't think that's acceptable. If you want to do that, this isn't the university for you. We also have quite strong policies on social media, and we expect real strong professional standards. And so we know that one of the issues around freedom of speech, for example, it's more about behavior than freedom of speech. I don't know what the right, the framing of this is interesting, but it's around the chilling effects, which are so difficult to untangle. If you are so provocative publicly, either in person or on social media, how does that impact somebody with a minority opinion within your campus who don't feel they're able to share it? And so we're trying to create a culture of civility within the institution that enables all voices to be heard. So, our strong policy on social media essentially is you're not down the pub, so don't behave like you're down the pub. If you want to wang off about something, do that down the pub, but not in a particular public forum.
So
Essentially.
banning incivility, I think, is an excellent way of
So it's not banning incivility. That's too strong. But we're banning academics trying to ban other academics. That's just not acceptable.
And then the final critical question is about your anthem. What music represents the university? What tune will you be playing as you are conferring that honorary degree on Jimmy Anderson?
Well, that's a really good question. So I have to say, my musical repertoire is not as strong as other people that have been on this podcast. So it's like, well, what should it be? But I think the Kinks. So the Kinks being very probably the most English of the 60s bands, if you want to put it in those terms, in terms of its lyric in their lyrics. Also very London-based now, not part of London that Harold Wood's in, but still very London. And our song is A Well-Respected Man. And the reason why we say that is it's clearly a lightly satirical take on the upper middle classes, Paul. And ultimately this is the source of university for the Ray Davises of the world. And we do, we're a bit chipper in a nice way. And we have a bit, and so that is sort of our anthem as an institution.
Lovely. Well, it's not one I'm familiar with, but I will go and listen to it right away. Listen, Richard, we need to stop there, but that's been a fantastic presentation of a really interesting and novel institution in a, well, for me, previously unheard of part of London. So I'm absolutely excited to see this proposition come to fruition, and I'm sure James Timpson will be as keen as anyone. To pour some money into it and to see it expand and succeed into the future. So thank you so much.
Brilliant. Thanks, Paul.
Well, I do hope you enjoyed that episode of My Imaginary University. There'll be more along before you know it. In the meantime, you might want to listen to the sister podcast, University Registrars Talking About Stuff, in which I chat to
university leaders and registrars and others like that, all about their experiences of higher education. Just Google it. Also, you may want to visit my website, wonderfulhighered.com, where you can find lots of entertaining stuff all about the strange, wonderful and frightening world of higher education. Anyway, until the next time, thank you for listening.